Welcome to Path to Glory, a Warhammer Underworlds podcast that focuses on competitive gaming, player development, and community growth. This is your host, Iman, and as always, I'm joined by Jonathan. How's it going, man?
Hello. It's going good.
Awesome. Well, today, for reference, the episode was recorded on June 28th, 2020, and we're going to go ahead and start with our community shoutouts. What do you have for us today, Jonathan?
I have a few things today. The first thing that I would like to talk about is to give a shout out to our two newest Patreons. That is Brandon Huss and Meat Reaver on Patreon.
Woo-woo!
thanks so much for supporting us. I also want to mention that the Deck Doctor channel, as we're calling it, which is available to the second level of Patreon, has already been a lot of fun. We've worked with Brandon on a Condemners deck and Valentin with a Wild Hunt deck. And I actually got a chance to play with Brandon, his Condemners against my Sep Guard, and that was a really cool game. It was actually 11-11 tie, and I think I was on more objectives, so very close.
Yeah,
That was a lot of fun.
I particularly enjoyed looking at Valentine's Wild Hunt deck and kind of the one I had been building or working on recently, and how, you know, someone's local meta can influence some of the card choices and deck design. I thought that was particularly fascinating because, like, when I'm building decks, I'm trying to build an all-comers deck. But I guess if you're mostly playing in your specific meta and you're aware of strategies and tendencies of your opponents, I think it's really cool that the game allows you to be able to play into that if you want to.
Yeah, I agree. I also just think it's fun to, like, look at someone's deck and really think about, you know, what I would change, and then also I just have to explain that. So I think it's also just helped me, like, it's a cool exercise to go through as well that I don't know if I expected. So definitely having a lot of fun with that. So thanks to them. The next thing I want to give a shout out is the Battle for Salvation podcast had their episode about the new FAR. So that they did a good job. They spent a lot of time on each card, sort of going over why they thought it had been restricted and then what the impact might be. So I thought that was interesting. One of the things that maybe I just didn't hear them correctly, I just wanted to clarify, the new Scurry FAQ, where if you move, then the Scurry would block the reaction for Snurk. If you charge, which is, I feel like usually Gitz players will charge and then Scurry off the charge, you can still inspire after that because of the way the reactions work. But I think they probably knew that. It's just a note I made, but it just wasn't super clear from listening to it. The next one I have is there is another online event on July 25th. This may be the largest one yet. We're going to talk today about the one that happened last week, but there is another one. So if anybody wants to play in that, then I would definitely recommend doing it. I think they're going to try to go up to 128. So that'll be pretty crazy.
Wild.
Yeah, we're not going to let the COVID get in our way, I guess. And I think we're probably both going to play in that one, right?
Yeah, I'll be playing in it.
Cool. So we'll probably talk over I think we'll have one episode between now and then. So what we may talk about as we get closer, what we might play in that one. The next thing I have is that we are starting the Path to Glory Warhammer Underworlds online. We're doing a league. It's a weekly league, and that is actually going to start today when this podcast comes out, which should be Monday the 29th. It'll have already started when this podcast comes out, but I do want to make it clear that if anybody wants to join at any time, you can basically just jump in. You may miss a week, and that might affect your monthly score, but you can still jump in and play games, and then the next month you should be ready to go. So definitely want as many people as possible for that. I think we're already in the 30s, so that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, super excited. I didn't realize the online game would kind of take off in the way it has, and I'm really happy that we have the opportunity to kind of assist in that growth. I know that it's mostly your baby, and so obviously it's really cool to see it, but even just chiming in and checking out what some of the people are playing and how they're doing and how they're really approaching the game with the same like love and passion and energy that people take to the tabletop version of the game is very cool.
Yeah, I think it'll be a fun way to get games in with different people. And I'm probably going to plan to try to, you know, be on a voice call with these people so that I can actually, like, it'll be a lot more like playing the tabletop game just through the computer. So we'll see how that goes. And then the next one, the last thing that I have is that we are also planning our Alliance format team league for the normal game. And we have one more week of signups before that starts. So if anybody wants to make a team, we definitely recommend that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. There is still time. So I think we're at 7 teams right now. We'd love to have one more. So we have an even number, but there's not really a limit to how many teams we can have. So bring it.
Yeah, and there's also looking for group channel. I know that there are a couple people looking for teams. I don't know if the 7th group was the Brandon Huss and two people from Australia, or if that's the...
I think yeah, so.
Okay. I don't know if that was the 8th one. Maybe I'm overcounting, but I know that there are plans for an 8th one, so I think we'll get 8.
Oh,
I'll
great.
I'll be very happy if we do, and then hopefully we can kick things off and see what people come up with.
Yeah, I think that'll be a lot of fun, and it'll be fun to follow the results as well, because I think it should pretty well match up with our podcast schedule.
Almost so. As if we did that by design.
Right. All right. We will do... I think that's everything that I have.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for those community shout-outs as always. And if we missed you this week, apologies. We'll get you on the next one. but let's go ahead and jump to the listener questions. So our first question is from Patreon member Brandon Huss. Were your predictions from the FAR podcast confirmed during the recent Vassal event? What strategies and decks were the most prevalent / successful? And how awesome is that a Season 1 Warband won? Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
I guess we'll, you know, let's go ahead and have you answer that one. What do you think your predictions were confirmed?
I almost feel like to say that they were confirmed would be to give my predictions too much credit. I think they were like exceeded and maybe just like blown out of the water. I feel like we thought things would be more even and more balanced and, you know, we'd see more representation, but I don't think I expected it to be as good as it was. So I think that's how I would answer that.
Yeah, I would almost agree 100%. I definitely knew that there'd be some warband shifting and a closer level of equilibrium, if you'd like to,
yeah,
you know, give it that term. But the fact that there's Eyes of the Nine in the top five, and then Skaven winning the event, is pretty cool. So, great far, and yeah, I would say that my predictions have been blown out the water, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that the Season 1 Warband took the event. I think we know it was not an easy event to win. And I think we'll go over what strategies and stuff were successful in that section.
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to cover that this episode.
Absolutely.
Cool. The next question is from Tris. They ask, do you guys think the restriction of faction-specific cards might help to avoid collateral damage to lower tier warbands in the future? And what do you think about a different kind of deck building restriction for certain cards that you can double up on? An example being Distraction, Nightmare in the Shadows. And they're saying that the restriction would say that you can only contain X or Y, but never both. And another example might be Tome of Offerings and Trophy Belt. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so to answer the first part of the question, 100%, mm-hmm. I think that restricting faction cards does avoid collateral damage to lower tier warbands.
Yeah.
I think the example that everyone likes to mention is when Cursebreakers get nerfed at the end of Night Vault, or got nerfed, Eyes of the Nine suffered the mm-hmm. most. And so we didn't want them to, because they were finally kind of improving the way that they functioned, and then that was taken away from them. So now, if there is a problem card or strategy that revolves around a certain faction card, restrict that card and doesn't affect anyone that, or any warband that's quote unquote in a lower tier, right? So
yeah, Yeah. What do you think about the second question?
So that's a really interesting one. For me, I don't know if you want to add limitations like that in the deck building process. I think one of the beautiful things about this game is that it's really simple in the way you build your decks, mm-hmm. play the game, and some of the things that you can do in the game. So no, I don't think that there should be a restriction on doubling up. I think mm-hmm. it's up to the onus is on the designers to avoid cards that can be manipulated in that manner. Like, I don't know if Tome mm-hmm. of Offering and Trophy Belt should have ever existed in the same meta. I don't know if Distraction and Nightmare probably should have either. So I think the easiest solution is to restrict one of them, and or in this case, both of them for Tome of Offering and Trophy Belt. Do you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think that basically, I would say that this rule actually already is in the game because it says if, you know, two cards with the same name, you know, you can't have two cards with the same name in your deck. And it's all, and the designers did that on purpose. And then I would assume that when they make a card that is very similar to another card, they also do that on purpose. And if they make, but if they make too many of a very powerful card, then I think that's a mistake. And I think that the Nightmare Distraction is a good example of that. So I think that ideally, anyway, this would be controlled in the design process, not the not through a FAR situation. I guess I could see, you know, a situation if, you know, it was, if they made too many cards like that and they thought it was a problem, I would probably just ban one of them or restrict them all or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be my thought. But in general, we don't have this problem because usually there's only one of each card. And then sometimes a faction will have their own copy of a card. And that's actually a really cool strength that certain factions can have. Like Skaven and Skeletons and Steelhearts all have a distraction and Moloch has a distraction. But that's almost like a feature, not a bug. But when you start getting three or four, it starts to get... You start to wonder, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of the FAR list, again, is that it's a Band-Aid, right? Yeah. So if there's a Band-Aid that needs to be slapped on or a challenge that needs to be fixed, then the FAR is there to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened with Distraction and Nightmare in the Shadows. Again, I would hope that the design team moving forward didn't make cards like that. I think... You know, it's really hard because I'm sure there's long lead times and stuff. But, you know, you really can't know what cards are going to do unless they're out in the wild. And in this situation, I think we all know that moving forward is probably not the ideal situation for any of the combinations mentioned in the question. And so I think moving forward, we will more likely not see repetitive cards exist in the same meta.
Yeah, I also think the flip side of that is I'm glad that they have the banned and restricted list to make these corrections, and that way, you know, they can sort of do what they want to creatively, and if they do make a couple mistakes, like, this is here to correct the problem. So
yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And I think this kind of goes into the next question.
Yeah, so that question is from Shuby. Which restricted cards could we salvage back by restricting certain warband specifics instead? And the example he gives is, if we restrict Foul Temper, can we unrestrict Longstrider? What do you think of that concept? I have thoughts on the Foul Temper versus Longstrider thing, but I would like to hear your thoughts.
I think the idea, honestly, has some merit. Basically, I think that we can look back in the past and we can say this card was only restricted because it was problematic with this warband. I think Longstrider is a great example. It's not really that great of a card until you have a fighter that can move twice reliably, and that's Moloch, and then it's one of the easiest, most powerful surges in the game for him. So theoretically, if you were to restrict a card that you know he would take, and I think Foul Temper is a great example of that, and then give everyone back another restricted card, nothing would actually change for Moloch, but... You know, everybody else would have another option. So I like the idea. I don't know if I feel like we need to do that for Moloch in this situation, but I would hope that from now on, if we feel like if a warband's doing too good, then I would hope that they do just take away a faction card rather than taking away universals that, you know, maybe aren't actually the problem. But I could see it. I mean, it's I think probably Mulligan is one of the only warbands left that is that specifically has cards on the list just for him. Although I guess Hrothgorn might be another contender for that spot.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like the idea of it for sure. You're absolutely right that if it doesn't really change the decision or the number of restricted cards the warband has to contend with, I do think that the cards would have to almost do similar functions. Like Foul Temper is an accuracy card, while Longstrider is a movement card. And I think that while Mulligan does love accuracy, there are other ways to find cards that can help induce that buff. Whereas I think if you were to unrestrict Longstrider and restrict Foul Temper, every Mulligan player would just probably take Longstrider, unless they're playing like pure aggro and they want every single attack to hit. Because now I think, especially in the way that Mike Carlin played them, you can play Mulligans that obviously want to fight you, but score a lot of their glory by not fighting you. And so in this particular situation, in this example, I don't know if the trade is truly one for one, but I do like the idea of exploring that. I like that option, and removing cards that are one for ones by replacing them with faction specific cards that are designed or intended to play into a similar strategy or do the same thing.
Yeah, because I think you make a good point. Because, for example, maybe if that switch was made, you would still take Longstrider, but then maybe you wouldn't take Foul Temper. Maybe you'd take Calculated Risk, and then you'd just take another accuracy upgrade, and maybe you'd be a little bit less accurate, but your objective deck is more reliable. And then so it would buff Mulligan a little bit. I don't know if that would actually be a problem, but I do think you're right that sort of thing would happen.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah. Let's go to the next question from Croton Hurst. Do you think the change to Varclav could mean that other pre-Beastgrave warbands could get an errata that changes the way they work? What do you think about that?
I think so. I mean, the answer would be clearly, I think, a yes. The problem with erratas is that they, whenever there's a different text to what is actually physically written on a fighter card or a card or even in the rulebook, it requires an external piece or an external document. And it's really, I guess, maybe challenging for newer players or players who are not necessarily familiar with miniature games to realize or know to look for an FAQ or an errata. So I think probably you won't see that as much because you don't want people to find that challenge or conflict. But I do think it's a great way to take down some of the more oppressive nature of warbands who are clearly either overstayed their welcome or who are more powerful than probably designed or intended to be. And I think Thorns is one of those examples.
I actually think you make a good point about overstaying your welcome. Like, I think one of the main reasons this was changed was because Thorns might have been too relevant. I don't know. I think you're right. I don't know if we want too many erratas because it does make things more confusing. So, I mean, like, I assume they're probably referring to, you know, buffing these warbands, which, while nice, I think that would get pretty confusing.
I think so.
Because there's a lot of, like, you could do a lot of changes.
Yeah.
You know.
You could. Yeah. I also think there's merit to, like, maybe just, you know, there's been a lot of hope and, like, ideas of just re-releasing or redoing some of the warbands. And I think that'd be really cool. Because instead of doing a bunch of erratas, just bring the older warbands up to date. I know that's been probably top of mind for everyone's wish list, aside from Magor and Farstrider alternate art cards. I think that would be a really cool way to kind of fix a lot of the challenges that warbands have, and then also kind of rein in some of the ones, like I mentioned earlier, who have overstayed their welcome, particularly maybe Thorns.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's really only a few things you actually could errata as well that would solve the problem. Most of the, I think those older warbands need new cards. So
yeah.
But it's a good question. Go ahead with the next one.
Yep. So this one is from Magor. There has been some conversation on the legitimacy of online events versus events in real life. What are your opinions on the difference between these two events? Do you think one is better than the other? It's a loaded question for sure, but we'll do our best. I guess I'll go ahead and put you in the line of fire first.
Okay. So I guess I would say I think it's obvious that they are different. I think, I mean, for me, I think if the question is which one is better, I think the live events are better. I think there's more to going to a live event and having that atmosphere. And I think it seems, to me, it seems like the stakes are higher. It's a lot more stressful. It's a lot more, there's just a lot more to it. So I would say, it's hard to say which one is. Just because I think the live events are better doesn't mean that I think that there's anything wrong with the online events. One of the things I've noticed with the online events, and I think I'm definitely one of the people that has done this, I don't think I take them as seriously as I would a live event that I'm traveling to and, you know, practicing for. I think there are people that do practice for these events and do take them more seriously than I do. I think I'm going to probably start taking them a little more seriously than I have. It's kind of a matter of priorities. But I would say I definitely think that they're legitimate. The online events that we talk about, I think there's been, three big ones so far. And I don't think you can deny that there is some top-level Underworlds happening there. And that this, I would also say, it's probably the biggest grouping of competitive players that is possible, because most of these most of the live events, you're not able to get as many of what I would consider to be, you know, like the highest tier of player skill, whereas I think we are able to get a lot more of that sort of condensed in the online formats. I don't know how seriously those players are taking it though, which I think is something that you can definitely consider. I know that I've taken Skaven. I know I took Hrothgorn to the last one. I didn't play in the other one because I was busy. So I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I think they're definitely worth something. I think especially the like top 8, top 10, I think you can tell those players probably are taking it seriously. And the games that happen in those later rounds, I think, are probably as difficult as any that you know, might take place at a Grand Clash. But I don't think you. I think playing online is in some ways more difficult because we may not have as much practice online. I also think that it's easier because you don't have all of the things going around you, and you don't have the stress of being there at a top table and things like that. So I look at them almost as completely separate things, but they're both very valuable in their own way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree in terms of how valuable they are. A lot of the things you said resonate with me, particularly, like, I don't know if I actually, I know for a fact I don't take them as seriously as I would an in-person event. And for me, it's kind of hard because, you know, there's a difference between, you know, buying a plane ticket or creating travel plans and have that energy and that vibe and having that purpose of traveling to an event with the sole intention of either doing really well or winning. Versus mm-hmm. kind of sitting at my home, you know, generally in my underwear, and then imagining the dice rolls by clicking things on a screen and moving pictures yeah. across a, you know, 2D board. And I understand that there are limitations behind the way that some of these events are played, right? Like we all play Warhammer Underworlds because it's a social, in-person, physical game, and we enjoy those aspects of it. And I think when you translate that into an online realm, like for some people that transition may seem seamless, and for a lot of people it probably is. I think for me personally, and some of my other you know, people I've spoken to that agree, is that for us it's a bit jarring. Like, you know, I think mm-hmm. I was talking to, you know, Tom the other day, Tom Bond, and he says, you know, it's weird how like Hrothgorn is actually such a large figure in person, but he looks the same size as everyone else on the board because of the limitations of the way that, you know, the online platforms do have. And I completely right. agree with that. So for me, I do think that there are a lot of people out there who put a lot of hard work, effort, and energy into these events. And it's kind of what's helping keeping the community alive in this the time and the age that we live in, with COVID and all that. So I would never ever take away from any of the achievements or success that people have seen in those events, because if you're taking it seriously and your opponents are taking it seriously, then it's top level prime time Warhammer Underworlds, and that's awesome. I guess because I can only really truly speak about my opinion, and the question was pointed to us, for me, again, you know, it's maybe something that I should want to work towards, and I think I will take the event a little bit more seriously than I have in the past. But again, for me, it's like, I like that pressure. I like looking at my opponent. I like taking advantage of the being physical with one another in terms of like presence, that I don't think you can do through a microphone. Looking at your opponent's expressions, the time they, like, you know, there's so many small things that you can do that can help edge you out in a physical game that you can't do here. I do think that the quality of players overall is probably better online because they're all over the world. So you're really getting the cream of the crop from the, you know, from Europe, from UK, from America, from Canada, and, you know, all over the other areas as well. So it's an interesting question. It's an interesting thought process that I have in regards to it. But again, I think the events are legitimate. But I also think that it's different when trying to compete for like a physical glass of trophy that you traveled for, and then, you know, online bragging rights, which to some people may be the same. To me, it's certainly not.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know how other communities, like, you know, chess versus online chess, or Magic versus the online version, or, you know, poker versus online poker. Like, I think it's, I would imagine that most people would agree that they're great, but they're completely different. I don't know. It's an interesting question. I mean, I think they're valid. I think they tell us things about the game and the meta, but I think they're definitely a different experience. And I would probably, I think if there was like a 60-man person, you know, in-person event at Warhammer World or whatever, and then there was the same size event online, I might put more stock in the results of the in-person one. I don't know if that would be correct, because I feel like maybe the online events have a lot fewer casual players, because I think most of the people that play online play a lot, and I'm not sure how many people that, you know, go to the large events, like what percentage of them might be casual. So
yeah,
it's very interesting.
It really is. And again, like, I have to restate this, like, for those people out there, especially some of our, you know, friends of the show and just friends in general, like, they put a lot of hard work and effort and energy into doing well at these events, and for that, you know, that is awesome. And you, if you win those events or you do really well and you're happy with your results, you should be proud of that, because you worked really hard, and I'm sure your opponents worked just as hard, or maybe not, because you beat them, right? But I think when it comes to any sort of game, I really like how you mentioned, like, online chess or online poker versus their physical versions. There is a difference. And I think, in general, maybe it's because of the way that we're brainwashed by the media, or just truly because the games were intended to be played in person, I think there is, for some reason, greater stock in physical events, where, you know, whether it's traveling to a location or playing at your store. But some of the best games I've seen have happened online. Some of the best moments have been really cool I've seen online. I would say that those moments and those plays and those games have also happened in physical person in front of my eyes, or I've played in them. But, you know, if we go over that last final, for example, like, that was really cool. And the way that the TO was able to kind of allow for a different ruling was neat, because, you know, this is an online event. You don't necessarily have to constrict yourselves to the confines of a physical rule book, right? Like, if you want to play a fourth game, for example, because the first three games have tied you up exactly, then that's really cool. That's awesome. But if, you know, but conversely, like, if that was a physical event, then it would have gone a completely different way. So, like you said, there's pros and cons to both. But I don't think it takes away from the legitimacy of online events, though I think the results from physical events are probably more legitimate in terms of, like, the official standard of the way things work for the game.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to compare, and then, like, maybe it's not even right to frame it as you have to decide which one is better, because, like, they're both great for what they are. So, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think the comparison comes because there's no physical events right now. Because these events have technically always happened, right? It's just they haven't had as much airtime because of the fact that there are larger events happening. Or maybe not larger is the right word, but there are physical events happening around the world. But now, because everyone is generally confined to their homes for a majority of the time, the onus or the rather the spotlight is on the only medium we have left, which is, you know, through a computer.
Yeah, and I do think it would be incorrect to say that they don't mean anything, or that, you know, they're not underworlds. I don't think that would be correct, but I think it's worth keeping in mind the limitations and what the differences are. So
I think that's very well said.
Cool. Well, I think that is it for the listener questions.
Yeah. Four solid questions. Thank you again for submitting those. And if you have any questions for us or would like to hear us ramble a little bit more, please do let us know in the Path to Glory Discord. You can also let us know on Facebook as well, as on our Facebook page. So the next segment that we're going to check into is actually a competitive event update. So I know that Jonathan has been running the Warhammer Underworlds Online League, and you've got an update to share.
Yeah, actually yesterday on Saturday we had the monthly final. The way we've been doing it is we'll have three weekly events, and then the fourth Saturday we'll have a monthly where basically the top eight from the month get to compete in like a three-round tournament. So that was a lot of fun. The turnout was good. We had eight players, and they were using five of the seven current warbands that are in the online game. It was cool that we had four warbands in the top four. They were all different. It was Orcs, Skaven, Magors, and Steelhearts. And then the top two were Magors and Steelhearts, and Steelhearts took it. I think we talked about it a little bit in one of the previous episodes. The player Invincible Prime was playing a defensive aggro sort of flex Steelhearts. That was really cool to watch. We did stream the whole thing on our Twitch channel. I had Michael Carlin in there a little bit to commentate one of the games, and it was just me for the rest of them. And I thought they were cool games. I think sometimes defensive play can seem a little bit boring, but every decision means so much, and it's cool to, once you know how the deck works, see how other people try to take it apart. And in this case, they weren't really able to, and Invincible Prime took it over with his Steelhearts, which aren't really the most popular warband on there either. So it's pretty interesting. I'm definitely looking forward to the next month's event, and we'll probably keep streaming the monthlies as well.
So. Right. So no Thorns in the top four, huh?
No. The only Thorn, there was only one player that chose Thorns of the eight, and I think they got knocked out in the first round.
Well, at least they're not overpowered everywhere.
But yeah, I think we thought they were going to
be. Yeah, I think we did too.
And it really just hasn't panned out like that. I think maybe just because Magors are pretty good into them.
Yeah, Magors are a great counter. It's interesting to see Invincible Prime live up to his name by winning two events in a row now. So
Yeah, he wasn't able to make the third one, but the two that he played in the second one and then the final, and took them both. So very cool to see that.
Yeah, control plays, it requires a lot of finesse, as you alluded to earlier. And so the fact that he is able to tap into both a control style and an aggressive style strategy is probably very cool. And I think the Steelhearts are one of the best warbands, at least in Season 1, to be able to execute that strategy.
Yeah, I think so. So that was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that update there. So let's look at the unofficial online event that occurred, because I guess we have to differentiate now. We use the word online a lot, so... this was the Curse of the Cat.
It's an online world.
It is an online world. So there was a recent Curse of the Cataphrane tournament, and this was TO'd by David I don't remember your last name. Starts with an L, though. And thank you for TOing the event. And
yeah, Beard Arm. By Beard Arm.
Beard Arm on Discord. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so very, very cool event. Lots of really great players who attended. And lots of great Warband representation as well. And Jonathan, because you're the master of stats, would you like to share some of those statistics with us today?
Sure, yeah. So this was a 44-player event. The players were playing 18 of the current 24 Warbands, so I think that's a pretty good spread. There were no Reavers, Chosen Axes, Iron Skulls, Condemners, Magors, or Godsworn. So I don't think we're too surprised by any of those. I think maybe Magors have some play right now.
I'm surprised there was not a single Magors player. There was no Khorne, actually, which blows my mind. Because the Warhammer community loves Khorne.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to fix that in the next one. I don't know. I haven't picked what I'm going to play yet, but Magors are fun. And then the most popular Warband was Gitz with 5 players. And then Skaven, Cursebreakers, Despoilers, and Rippas had 4. Skaths, Steelhearts, Wormspat had 3. And then there were 2 of each. Thundrix, Yeltharis, and Hrothgorn. 1, Sepgard, Thorns, Eyes, Molag, Harrows, Grimwatch. So just really, really spread out, which was pretty cool.
And 2 Farstriders, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, 2 Farstriders. Sorry. Farstriders, Thundrix, Yeltharis, and Hrothgorn. Yep. So I just think that that variety is kind of incredible. I don't know if we've seen that much of a spread, really, in the past.
I like the fact that, and this kind of answers Brandon's question from earlier, that, as you can see, this kind of exceeded our expectations for how well the far list would translate, how many avenues have opened up for players. And I think now is one of the few times in Underworlds where you can take a warband that you like and make it do, or help it do really well based with practice, skill, and time, right? Previously, there were just some warbands who just did things better, and there was just no way around it. But now, you can maybe find a way around it or minimize those weaknesses to the point where you can do it just as well, and then with a little bit of practice, maybe do it better. So the fact that Eyes are in there, Sepulchral Guard are in there, the fact that there are 3 people who took Steelhearts Champions, that's crazy. In a great way. 4 Despoilers, too. Yeah. I'm like, really? 4? Wow. So,
I think one of the things that they mentioned on the Battle for Salvation podcast recently was that the best time to try out a warband that you haven't tried in a while is right after the far list updates, because everything is so new and fresh. And I think it's pretty clear that a lot of people were doing that.
Yeah.
Which I don't think that takes anything away from any of the results of this event, but I do think that's something to be aware of, and I wouldn't be surprised if in the next event we see a little bit narrower of a focus as people have practiced more and sort of determined what they think is at the top. But I still think that just the fact that everything was so spread out, the most popular one was Gitz, and I think that those are really good, but I don't know if I think those are the obvious choice either. You know, I think people just like playing them.
Yeah. So. Well, it's also like it's a different warband, and there's been some pretty decent finishes with them prior to this event. So I think it's like, hey, older warband, cooler strategy, because like a bunch of Amberbone weapons, and then, you know, they've done pretty decently. Maybe they'll do even better after the far list, which didn't seem to touch them too much. So I think you're absolutely correct, and BFS is right in that, you know, best time to try a new warband is immediately after the far. And, you know, for this event particularly, you had 2 days to figure it out. Yeah. And some things worked and some things didn't. And so, you know, it's all about trying to get those games in and figure it out and putting in that time. And so while I do think this is a great opportunity to see what the meta can potentially look like, I would like to see at least one more event, if not 2, to kind of level set and see where the meta's truly landed, because I still think some of the people, or the warbands rather, that were at the top previously are still just as good. I mean, the fact that you have Thorns in the finals means that despite sudden appearance going restricted and the limitation to Varclav's push, they're still in a great spot. So, you know, it's really cool to see some of the other warbands come up, but are they going to stay up? That's the question.
Yeah, I think you're right. One of the, other than just the representation, one of the really cool things about this one was that the top 12 warbands were all different warbands too. I don't know if we've ever seen anything like that before.
I think maybe the last event, right? Or maybe there was Molag twice.
You know, maybe, but I'd have to check. I don't think it was this varied. Not to 12.
Yeah, not to 12. That's fair. I think that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, we've probably seen, you know, four different warbands in the top four or something like that. But, I mean, 12 different warbands. And then if you looked at who was below them, like the first duplicate, I think, is Yul'Tharis, who we haven't seen really in a while. I know that Duncan Bills took them to, I think, right below the finals. Maybe he was like fifth or sixth or something like that. In the previous one, but now we see another player also doing that, Michael. And then below that we have Farstriders again, and then we have Skaven again, and then only after all of that we have the first Hrothgorn player, which was me. So it's just super varied, and very, very cool to see that like maybe what warband you pick isn't actually as important as it used to be. You know, maybe it has more to do with luck and skill and matchups and things like that, which I think is great.
Right. And were you referring to placement or just win rate just now?
I was referring to the placement.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, because we had Skaven, we had Thorns, Gits, Wild Hunt, Eyes, Harrows, Wormspat, Yul'Tharis, Grashrex, Despoilers, Farstriders, and then we had Cursebreakers, and we didn't have. And then we had Rippas as well. So those were the 12. And then we didn't have a duplicate until 13th, which was another Yul'Tharis.
So there was no... Was there no Hrothgorn or Grimwatch in the top 12?
No. And only one person brought Grimwatch, and only two brought Hrothgorn. Most likely they were probably just sick of them. Mm-hmm. I think they're both still really good warbands. I actually had not been playing much Hrothgorn, so I wanted to bring him. I was playing very aggressive, and I had a little bit of hold objective in there. So I don't think that's probably the most, the best way to play him. But yeah.
I mean, it's,
I wanted to try it out.
It's still cool to see that. I mean, you have Eyes in fifth, Guardians in eighth, Despoilers in ninth, Farstriders in 10th, Steel or Cursebreakers in 11th, Rippers in 12th. Like, you know, kind of cool to see this variance. It's just scrolling online on Underworld's DB and like looking at the top 12. It's like every icon is different, and that's a really cool thing to look at. So,
yeah, I think it's great. I mean, to me, that is probably one of the best indicators of like the current game health. And like I said, I expect it to narrow down a little bit, but it's just really cool that that's what happened.
100%.
I guess we'll go over some of the win rates real quick.
Sure.
The factions with the best win rates where Lady Harrows had 75, but that was just one player who did really well. Farstriders had two players. They had a 71% win rate, so there definitely may be something there. Thorns had 71. That was one player as well. Just the fact that only one player picked Thorns is pretty cool.
But it was like one of the best Thorns players on the planet. So
absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And then Yul'Tharis had 66. Skaven had 62. Eyes had 60%. That was one player as well. Hrothgorn Despoilers had 50, and there were four Despoilers players and they went 50-50, so that's pretty cool. And then Molag and Sepgard were also at 50, so it's just really cool to see that many warbands at positive or better win rates.
Yeah, it's really nice to see, and there's obviously some missing there, and hopefully we can see that bump up in the next event. But if
I think we will, as we get more data, I think we'll see things average out a little bit more, but
yeah, definitely so. But there's also that risk of, you know, the meta shrinking a little bit because people are going to figure out what's the best in the current state of the game. So
yeah, I think we'll figure out what's like most like obviously the best, and then it'll be a matter of like, okay, well, what counters that, and then it'll just keep shifting from there as it usually does.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, really, really encouraging to see the results and those win rates, and looking forward to seeing what comes next. But just wanted to give a special shout out. We mentioned earlier that Skaven did win the event, and that event was actually won by Ollie Bond as part of Steel City Underworld's team. So shout out to them. I think they're now top team on BCP, or if they weren't already, they are now. So really excited to see.
Yeah, they are.
To see that, I mean, season one Warband, that's crazy. Skaven 2 being something that was considered middle of the pack, now taking the event, and you know, reinforces the whole concept that movement is key in this game, because all of those guys start with 5 movement, and it's huge.
Yeah, it's really cool, Warband, and very happy to see Ollie. Apparently, this was his first tournament win of any kind ever.
Oh, really? So
that was really cool.
Awesome. Well, what a way to kick things off.
Yeah, I think they're also going to mail him a trophy. I think maybe it was Brandon Huss that is making that happen.
So. Yeah, awesome. More trophy support is great.
That's wrong. Somebody let me know. But I know he's getting a trophy, and it's going to be his first one, which is really cool.
I'm happy to hear that, and he worked really hard for it. So 4 games in the final alone.
Absolutely, yeah.
There were some cool decks that, you know, we've already mentioned that made it into the top. And so we wanted to pick out, you know, a couple decks that we thought, 2 each actually, that we thought were really cool and particularly worth discussing. So I'll go ahead and kick things off. In typical fashion, I gravitated towards the Wild Hunt deck. So this is Baden's Wild Hunt deck. It was very nice to see an aggro playstyle make it to the top 4.
Yeah.
And gives me hope that, you know, that playstyle can kind of resurge a little bit. I tried to keep it alive, but this is the first time we've seen it do really well in a very large event. So just running through the deck, the objectives: calculated risk, fired up, frugal, keep chopping, solid gains, hunt's end, run down, slay the corrupted, brought to bay, gathered momentum, bold conquest, and cover ground. The interesting thing there is there's no run through, which is probably the superior choice. Because it's so leader dependent. But then, interestingly enough, Bold Conquest is in the deck. So maybe there was too much reliance on Skaith, so he went with one or the other. And so that's a pretty interesting choice there. I really like Slay the Corrupted. In the past, I wouldn't have thought that you would probably include this card, but with some of the restrictions, this is a great faction card to flex back into, because if you are playing Wild Hunt, you're probably playing it aggressively, and if you are playing it aggressively, you're probably taking out fighters. And so especially in some of the larger warbands that are decently popular right now, you can probably take out 3 pretty quickly. And if you're playing something like a 3-man warband, then you want to table them anyways, because each of those fighters hits like a truck. So
I really think that's really interesting.
Jumping to Gambits, we've got Determined Effort, which I saw a meme which was really funny in regards to, like, don't know what to put in, throw in Determined Effort. But this is actually a great card for a warband that's aggressive, because it just increases your likelihood to hit, right? And that's so important. Keeping in line with that, Haymaker, Pit Trap, Inspired Attack, Hunt in Concert, Sitting Target, Snare, Tracking, Distraction, Spectral Wings. I like how he went with both Tracking and Spectral Wings, and it also plays really well into his objectives with Cover Ground and Gathered Momentum in case you want to do it with an uninspired fighter. So pretty solid there. And then again, Haymaker, Inspired Attack, Sitting Target, and Determined Effort. 4 accuracy-inducing gambits, and then Snare and Pit Trap, of course, helping you take down those fighters. And then in the upgrades, we've got Glory Seeker, Potion of Rage, Tome of Offerings, Spectral Armor, Great Strides, which is +2 movement, again, plays into that those objectives I mentioned earlier, Great Fortitude, Great Strength, Sting of the Urgrub, Eye of Kurnoth, and Hail Charm. So, you know, you take their 2 best upgrades, which are Eye of Kurnoth and Hail Charm, which helps your fighter stay alive longer and hit harder, or more accurately, rather, and then taking all those Great Strength and that Sting of the Urgrub, and then that accuracy, and then Tome of Offerings for that glory bump. It's a pretty well put together deck. I think most Wild Hunt cards are taking, I would say, like 80% of the same cards, but I really like how he flex into the movement, which really helps with board setup. And then Slay the Corrupted, I think, is a very cool choice that I missed myself personally, but now I'm definitely taking a look at moving forward.
Yeah, I think one of the cool things about the FAR right now is that because they've removed, or I would say mostly effectively removed, combination strikes and opening gambit, it really makes you sort of reconsider what a good end phase card is. And I think we're starting to see a few more come up. But the Wurmspat have a similar card. I think they have to kill three fighters. And then Hrothgorn has Butchering, which is, I believe, kill half of the enemy warband. And these are two glory end phase cards that in some matchups you'll score in the second round. Maybe even the first round. You know, it's not unheard of for Wild Hunt to get three kills in some matchups. And if that happens, that's incredible. If it happens in the second round, that's great. And then we've seen end phase cards like To the End, which is two glory. And that's effectively a third end phase card, but that's, you know, it's good. This could be in the second end phase. So I think we might see more of these. I think it's a really good pick.
It certainly tempts me. It's like the improved version of the deck I took to LVO for the skirmish. And I think there's a lot of great choices here and some choices that, like Determined Effort, I'm curious if there is really a better option out there or not. So very well designed deck, very well put together, and obviously very well played. So congrats, Baden, for a great performance, getting top four with an aggro-style warband. And, I mean, that's super cool, honestly.
Yeah, I think that if you're preparing for an event, this is a great deck to keep in mind because you may face something that is this aggro, and you need to be prepared for it. So I think that's cool.
100%. So moving on to the next deck, I know that you've picked a pretty, pretty solid one. You care to share?
Yeah. So this is the Tommy's second place deck with Thorns of the Briar Queen. I do just want to give him a shout out. I watched a few of the games, and I was just really impressed by just how well piloted the deck was. Obviously, Tommy's a great player. This was just the first time I had got to see it in action, and I thought it was very cool. I don't play this style of deck that much, so to see somebody that really has it down, very similar to Dean Bills, who we've talked about a lot, just really cool to see somebody, you know, really using all the tools to their disposal. So I really enjoyed that. Let's go through the deck. The objectives are Treacherous Foe, Branching Fate, Shortcut, Swift Capture, Temporary Victory, Bold Conquest, Fired Up, Solid Gains, Tactical Supremacy 2 and 5, Path to Victory, Supremacy, Uncontested. The cool thing that I like about this deck is there's not really there's not really anything that you need dice for here, except for Branching Fate. So, which I feel like Branching Fate will usually happen. I think there's like if you make four attacks, I think it's like a 90% chance for it to happen. Everything else is basically just, you know, did he do the thing that he was trying to do, like Treacherous Foe, Shortcut, Swift Capture? And then in the end phase, you know, does he have that condition met? So Uncontested, Supremacy, Path to Victory. I guess that one needs a kill, but, you know, you'll probably get one. And then Fired Up is pretty easy. Solid Gains is the only sort of win more card, but it's so reliable. I think that sometimes, you know, you'll make a deck that requires dice to go your way, like, you know, Headshot or something like that. Or and if you have too many of those, like, they can kind of bite you if the dice don't go in your direction. And I feel like he's really minimized that in this deck. We'll go through the gambits and upgrades real quick, too. Sudden Appearance, Counter Charge, Shifting Reflection, Two Steps Forward, Buried Instinct, Confusion, Distraction, Mischievous Spirit, No Time, which I think is a very interesting choice, and Howling Vortex. In the upgrades, we have Driven by Hatred, which is a faction card that is plus one dice on the charge. I don't think I even knew that the Thorns had this card until I saw him playing it, but that's a really good card. So I thought that was really cool. Duelist Speed, Faneway Crystal, Glory Seeker, Sudden Growth, Quickening Greaves, Spectral Armor, Great Strength, and then two of the keys, Fractured, which is for number five, and Shadowed, which is for number two. So he did take the same two keys as his Tactical Supremacy, which I think makes sense. If you're going to try really hard to hold those two, then you may as well also have the keys for him. I do wonder if that may be a weakness in an objective removal sort of matchup, but I don't know if there's, I don't know if that's worth planning for, and this may be more consistent.
Yeah, so obviously a really cool deck here. I did want to comment, but I didn't want to slow your roll, was Tommy's a great player. I think one of the things that, or at least the way that we play, we don't necessarily focus on objective play as much. I mean, we definitely know how to do it, and we've done decently well with it, but there are people who can take it to another level, and I think, you know, we've talked about Dean, and then Tommy is probably another person I put in that category, so definitely kudos to him. I know if he's listening, he's gonna get real chuffed about it, but you know, Tommy loves talking a little bit of smack, so don't worry, Tommy. I'll talk some smack when we play on online for sure. But I really like the fact that he's focused on two objectives, or two particular objectives in general, two and five. He doesn't care where they're going to be because he has the tools to get there, and he's going to get them no matter what. So in his game plan, he always knows, jump on as many objectives as you can. There is a preference, though. I'm going to prioritize two and five, and I'm going to prioritize those cards because I can score a potential of six glory from those cards. Or those objectives specifically from two and five. And then on top of that, it plays really well into Path to Victory, Supremacy, and Uncontested. The really cool thing is, you mentioned No Time. That's great because this deck relies so much on jumping onto objectives and holding them. So if you literally have the perfect setup going into the third end phase, or going into the end phase, you can just slap down a No Time. And then there's nothing your opponent can do to stop you from doing what you've done already, which I think is an amazing tech piece. I don't know if it makes every deck, but it certainly makes a deck that functions in the way that Tommy has designed his deck to hold objectives and hold them well. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. Okay. One of the things that I thought was really cool about the gambits is if you look at the gambits and then you look at the objectives, every single one of his gambits is able to help him score those objectives. Like, and this is actually something that John Rees and David Smee, I think, talked about on his recent podcast, is you should really make sure that your ploys can help you score your objectives. And every single one of these, like, he doesn't even have the attack again card for the thorns. Everything here is focused on positioning. Buried Instinct will keep you on an objective when maybe you would have been pushed off. You know, Howling Vortex is going to help clear out objectives, or you know, get the enemy off of them for Uncontested. Mischievous Spirits is obviously great, and then, like you said, No Time. I mean, there were a couple times that Tommy would win the roll off in the second round, for example, and then go second because he knew he had No Time. So all he had to do was, in his last activation, have the board state that he wants, and then play No Time, and it's his. And that was really, really cool to watch.
100%. And I think the lack of Treacherous Foe is definitely a...
Not Treacherous Foe. What's it called?
What is it? Driven by Hatred? Fueled by Hatred? Like,
no. It's the same Tireless Assault.
It's like Fueled by Hatred. Whatever. We know what it is. The reroll when you miss.
I'm just drawing. I'm drawing the biggest blank in my head.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah, whatever. So so that makes sense, though, right?
Endless Malice.
There we go.
There it is. Too many card names.
Yeah, there really are. I think that makes sense. And it's definitely, you know, you'd probably ask someone, you asked a random person, like, hey, I'm playing Thorns, should I take Endless Malice over No Time? And everyone's going to be like, dude, take Endless Malice. But if you look at the way, again, this deck has been designed, Endless Malice doesn't help him score any of these cards, at least not reliably. You could maybe argue Branching Fate and Treacherous Foe, but he's already got the ammo for Treacherous Foe, and Branching Fate, again, is something that eventually will happen. And then I think why I like Driven by Hatred is it because it allows some sort of redundancy or a backup plan if the queen goes down early, because then Varklav or the Everhanged can make a charge and have three dice on the charge. So that plays into Branching Fate. So lots of really cool cards here. Lots of strategy.
It's interesting to see Driven by Hatred instead of Potion of Rage or Vendetta, Prize Vendetta. Because although it's not as good as those cards in a single attack, assuming the queen kills the target of Prize Vendetta, like those cards are kind of dead afterwards. I've seen, you know, Driven by Hatred in some of his games get, you know, two attacks out, or, you know, I don't know if I've seen three, but I'm sure there were games when he got, you know, three charges off. That's really cool. I think Duel of Speed is also really cool because it helps you score Bold Conquest, Temporary Victory, Swift Capture. You can charge, hit somebody, push them off, and then push onto the objective they were holding, or, you know, you can charge next to an objective that maybe was out of your range and then slide onto it, and you'll still score all those cards. So that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, good points there as well. Going back to Driven by Hatred, if you get it out early, that's, and mm-hmm. you have Branching Fate, again, super way to make sure that you can get the card. And also, if you really just need to kill stuff, you got the tool mm-hmm. there, because the queen hits like a truck if, you know, when you really get her going with great strength. So great cards.
It also lets Varklav and the Everhanged score Branching Fate too, which is cool.
Exactly. Yeah, I said that earlier. But as a backup plan for the queen.
That's what you meant. Yeah, yep. Gotcha.
So, again, a really cool deck. It's really nice to see it because every card has a purpose, has a particular slot in, like, this finely crafted piece of armor. And, you know, without any, you know, with, if you replace any of those cards with other cards, I think it wouldn't be as great of a deck. So very finely tuned, hard crafted, solid deck, and no surprise it did so well. But there's a clear game plan, and the cards are there to support it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next deck, which I thought was really cool, is an Eyes of the Nine deck. You know, we make fun about Eyes of the Nine from time to time. The community likes to mess around with them, but it's one of those few warbands where if you really have someone focus in on trying to make them work, they are surprisingly pretty powerful. So let's go ahead and take a look at this fifth place deck. And this deck was created by Eric with a K. So mm-hmm. looking at the surges, we've got Kalkrisk, Martyred, Shortcut, Warning Shot, Frantic Exchange, and Swift Capture. I really like Warning Shot because Tarash and Narvia's range attack is pretty terrible. And then from time to time, you will miss with Vortimus. So really mm-hmm. solid card there. Shortcut's great because they have a lot of in-faction jumping cards. Going at the end phase, the restricted slot went to Combination Strike, which this is so interesting to me. All three go mm-hmm. into restricted or objectives, but Combination Strike stands out to me as something that perhaps could have been replaced with something else. But if you look at the way that his deck is designed, there's four glory multipliers. Combination Strike, Gate Gain, Solid Gains, Aggressive Strategy, and then Path to Victory and Uncontested, because I think those are pretty staple if you're trying to play any sort of control or objective style gameplay. Jumping to Gambits, Deceitful Step, Center of Attention, Shifting Reflection, Confusion, Sidestep, Daylight Robbery, which has been very popular as of late, mm-hmm. actually cost me a game in one of the in the recent event, because it's a two glory swing for a 50-50, pretty decent, especially when you're trying to play that control game. Distraction, Jealous Defense, Mischievous Spirits, and Arcane Transposition, which is a magic shortcut. So,
right.
as you mentioned earlier, all these cards here help score the cards in the surge pile. And then Mischievous Spirits and Distraction really help with Uncontested and Path to Victory. So I think this style is a little draw dependent, but I guess you mm-hmm. can afford to throw away some of your hands because you still have 18 glory and you're playing kind of a denial game almost. So I really do like the idea here. And then Archer's Focus, Crown of Avarice, Glory Seeker, Tome of Glories, Quickening Greaves, Spectral Armor, Great Fortitude, Empowered Sorcery, which is +1 damage to spell actions for Vortimus, Eldritch Ward, and Yara's Instant Shield. So definitely the tools here to pump up Vortimus and make him a little bit of a late game threat. And then again, trying to stay alive, Glory Denial with Clown of Avarice. And then Archer's Focus is really neat because if you really want to score a Warning Shot, you can just reroll to make sure you miss. So,
Yeah.
I like
it. That's true. I think this is a good example of the sort of objective play that we might see in the future from some of the smaller war bands with Uncontested, Path to Victory. And then there's so much like mobility in the gambits that I'm not too surprised that you know, they're able to score those consistently. And then when they do score, they're just also going to get a lot of their other end phase cards, like Great Gains and Solid Gains, probably Combination Strike. So I wouldn't say that I'm not surprised to see it do well, but looking at it, and then I'm sure it just had a great player behind it. Fifth out of 44 is no slouch. So very cool to see. I feel like there's always an Eyes player that takes on that challenge and does really well, and everyone's like, "What?"
Yeah,
but
I mean, it's a really a finesse warband, and if you want to put in the time and effort to be able to finesse at that level, then you should be rewarded. And I think Eric did a great job. I do think the draws can be kind of tough on the objective side,
mm-hmm.
because they're so dependent on surges. You know, I guess over the course of the game, the draws kind of worked out, or the tournament rather. So really nice to see that. Cool stuff there. Always nice to shout out the Eyes players that exist, all 10 of them. So
yeah, and I think if you compare it to the previous two decks, it's interesting because it shares some of the things from Tommy's deck with the, you know, Uncontested and Path to Victory, but it really relies a lot more on just scoring its other objectives and then that glory multiplying. And then it looks like Fortimus probably does turn into a bit of a monster. He's still one of the best wizard leaders in the game. I think sometimes it feels like the rest of his warband might hold him back a little bit, but I think it's interesting. And then, you know, obviously it's completely different than the Wild Hunt deck. So
yeah,
like just the fact that we have such varied decks, you know, that made the top eight is really cool to me.
Yeah, and I think I'm happy to see it, and I'm looking forward to it. I think that there is maybe Lost Pages play potentially available as well. So
yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if Eyes crop up a bit more in the future.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of our four, but I know Duncan Bills played a Lost Pages Ilatharis, and I bet you could do something very similar with Eyes of the Nine.
100%. So, I think even the redundant Guardians that you mentioned earlier, the next repeating warband, mm-hmm. was Lost Pages as well. So.
Oh yeah, the second one too. Okay, yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I think it is viable. And interestingly, I think the wizards with the double dodge may actually be, once they get tooled up all the way, they may actually be a little bit harder to kill than a tooled up Storm Sire. So
yes,
especially if you spend a slot on Survival Instincts,
so. Right? Which we haven't seen yet, but I'd love to see someone really just go all in. Enough about Eyes. Zinch is getting annoyed. We're giving him too much attention. So let's jump to your second deck that you chose. It's probably one of the most interesting.
Yeah, the second one is the deck that won, Ollie's Skaven. Obviously, I am a pretty big fan of Skaven, and I think the way that he put these together is really cool. We'll go through the objectives. It is Martyred, Shortcut, Frantic Exchange, Gathered Momentum, Swift Capture, Bold Conquest, Digging Deep, Fired Up, Great Gains, Lethal Repertoire, which I think is one we probably haven't seen too much of, To the End, Uncontested. The gambits are Scratching in the Shadows, There Are Always More, Shadowed Step, Shifting Reflection, Confusion, Frenzied Search, which is a restricted, Nightmare in the Shadows, which is restricted, Unnatural Truce, Distraction, Mischievous Spirits. Then in the upgrades we have Crown of Avarice, Nullstone Sword, Swordbreaker, Tome of Glories, Quickening Greaves, Amberbone Spear, Cryptic Companion, which is his third restricted, Great Strength, Black Hunger, and Expendable. One of the things I think is really interesting about this, actually we can directly compare it to the previous one, which had three restricted objectives. This deck doesn't have any restricted objectives, which is pretty interesting to me. If you look at it, the Cryptic Companion is sort of like an objective in that you're getting glory from it, so I think that makes sense. And then pretty much everything else in the gambits is there to either score shortcut, which he has three ways to do that, which I think is probably a good way to make sure that it actually happens. I know I have usually been playing with two and then some card draw, and I found that to be good, but I'm sure that, you know, the occasional game that I lose because I don't have shortcut scored, you know, he may get around that with a third source. So I think that's interesting. But everything else there is either to draw cards, which will help him get Frantic Exchange, Digging Deep to the end, or it's mobility, which, you know, is key to Uncontested and just being able to get to the fighters that you need to. So very cool there. And then the upgrades is mostly either ways to get more glory or ways to kill people or to disincentivize the opponent from attacking his fighters through Expendable and Crown of Avarice. So I think it has a lot of synergy to it, and I think it's a really well put together deck.
Completely agree. I think my favorite part about the deck, as someone who would play it, not against someone who would play against it, would be, you know, having Tome of Offerings or Cryptic Companion on a fighter with either Crown of Avarice or Expendable on it. So it allows you to, again, like you mentioned, disincentivize your opponent from going after those fighters, but then you're still able to kind of do what you want to do. And also take the threat level off some of your, like, I guess, less powerful fighters. And because everyone tries to prioritize Scritch, right? And Kirk. Mm-hmm. But like when you watch Ollie play the game, he kind of threw Kirk around because he's like, I don't care if you take Kirk out. The little guys are more important to him. And of course, Scritch getting at least a kill or two and you know, taking some of that threat off the smaller guys and taking that attention off and having your opponent focus on him for a little bit kind of really reinforces the play style of this deck, because there's a lot of objective holding. There's a lot of benefiting from holding at least a single objective. And then every single card in his Surge deck doesn't require a roll. So you have this level of consistency where no matter what, you're going to be able to do similar things. Like, you know, I took a Profiteer's deck to this event, and my Surges are, four of the six are the exact same. And I scored all of those in every game because, and the reason I mentioned that is because it's just so unreliable. So if you're going to get Surges that you know you're going to score no matter what, and you're going to cycle through your deck, then you can focus on using those gambits and those upgrades to make sure that you can just hold off on those end phase cards. You're probably going to take the game. And there's some really cool moments as well. Like, you know, Skaven, since their inception, have been great weapon caddies, right? So you've got the sword, Nullstone Sword. You've got Swordbreaker. You've got the Amberbone Spear, which, again, provides you a little bit more glory. But the cool part is Black Hunger, because that can make for some epic moments. And we saw an epic moment in that final, right? It was crazy. Where you know, I forget which was, the Lurking Skaven maybe?
It has to be Hungering,
Hungering Skaven with, that makes sense, Black Hunger. I don't play much Skaven, guys. You know, with, I think, either Swordbreaker or Nullstone Sword, and just jumps in, swings at three fighters, including Varklav and the Briar Queen, and then takes them all out.
It was like a lot of crits all at once.
Yeah, and I was just, I was like, that's really insane. You know, like the fact that that potential is there is huge, but Ollie never relied on it. Like, I think Ollie would have gotten one kill, he would have been happy. But the fact that he kind of like crit into three was pretty, pretty cool. And won him the game and the tournament. So, very, very well put together deck. And I really like how the Surges, or the, sorry, the restricted cards, are cards that we just recently saw added. So this goes to show that like this deck almost had the potential. It just needed other decks to get nerfed a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Again, redundancy, every card helps score the objectives. And if you have a great pilot, someone who's been putting in practice, you're going to do well. So.
Yeah, and I think this kind of shows us what I consider to be like the fourth archetype of deck right now, which is the To the End deck. I think when you have To the End, Digging Deep, Frantic Exchange, and then Unnatural Truce and Frenzied Surge to support it, I would basically consider any deck with those, with that sort of combo of those five cards, to be a To the End deck. And I think this is an archetype that a lot of warbands can do pretty well. I think Eyes can do it. I think Thundrix can do it. Hrothgorn. You know, almost anybody could play this way if they want to. It only takes one restricted card, and it kind of lets you have a bit of a passive strategy. You know you're going to be able to get to the end of your deck. You're going to score two glory off of that. It is effectively a third end phase card, so it can sometimes come out earlier than you want it to, which I think is a good weakness. But there's a lot of synergy, just the way those cards work together. And, you know, this is Underworlds. The more cards you have and the more helpful those cards are, the more power you can have a lot of the time in your rounds. If your opponent only has five power cards and you have eight or nine in a round, you're going to have like a tech advantage in a lot of situations. And I think you see a lot of the time these decks will take a lot of mobility, a lot of things that are able to change the board state. Like this one does. I mean, this doesn't even have a single damage or accuracy upgrade in the gambits at all. It's all about card draw and mobility. So I think that's really interesting, and I think it's clearly effective. I think one of the cool things about this deck in particular is that it combos that to the end style with the ability of the Skaven to make all of their targets pretty annoying through Crown of Avarice and Expendable. And then, and like you mentioned earlier, there would be situations where he had Expendable or Crown of Avarice on the same fighter with Cryptic Companion or Tome of Glories, and you're like, man, I can't let them get the glory, but if I kill them, I don't get anything, or I give them one of my glory. Like, I think I saw Tommy actually basically forced to give Ollie Crown of Avarice kill because he couldn't let Cryptic Companion stay on the board anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And making your opponent make those really bad choices is just so good for winning games.
Yeah, and the one thing we haven't mentioned yet, and that this is probably like the icing on the cake, is that they'll just come back.
Yeah, I know. And I actually played Ollie in the second round, and at one point I had this situation where I needed to get a kill. One of my objectives required me to get a kill, but I knew that fighter was, it was possible for them to come back with There Are Always More, and they had the Nullstone Sword. So I was kind of put in this weird situation where, I had to try to get the kill and then hope they didn't have the card. And of course he did. Partly because he's just got so much card draw, you know, there's a pretty good chance he will. And, that caused me a headache later, so.
Yeah.
Very cool to see it all in action. And I did beat him pretty soundly in the first match, and then he got me the other two. So it was pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Ollie played a lot of games going to game three, and in some cases game four. Yeah. But, it's the consistency that he has in his deck and the redundancy that allows him to get that edge. So while he may drop a game from time to time, dropping a set is probably unlikely, right? So, anyways, lots of great decks. Again, congratulations to everyone that placed, who first of all participated, that's awesome, who placed in the top 12, and then of course top 4, and then the final with Ollie taking it. So congratulations to everyone, and thank you for giving the opportunity for us to discuss this event and your decks. We love talking about stuff like this, and it's exciting. So we're going to go ahead and jump to the second to last segment we've got is the meta. So again, this kind of ties into Brandon Huss's question from earlier, but, we've talked a lot about what the meta is going to look like. I wrote an article on what the meta looked like prior to the FAR, and then, we had some anticipations on what it could potentially look like moving forward. And so I guess to ask you a question, what are your meta picks for the next set of events? I think there's some obvious ones, but, I'd really love to hear some rogue choices from you as well.
Yeah. One of the warbands that I think I may have discounted in the previous one, although I think they had some success, I think is Rippas. I think Rippas are going to be more viable than they were before. I think they might have a couple bad matchups, but I played Rippas in the first match, and at the event there, and I just got wrecked. I was playing Hrothgorn, kind of an aggro Hrothgorn, and the ability for, like, one of the things about Rippas is they don't really give up a lot of kills. And, like, you're only going to probably lose two fighters over the course of most of your games. So there's only so many things people can score off of that. And then they have a lot of reliable glory. I think the player I was playing against had Conquest and Loaded with Plunder and the card they have for killing two enemy fighters and having someone in enemy territory. Basically, all of those, that's six reliable glory that they probably will score almost no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that combined with how little glory they give up and how, you know, they throw a lot of dice, so they'll probably get some kills. I think they're going to be a tough one. I'm not sure if I have any other that I feel like are maybe a surprise. I feel like Gitz and Thorns are in great spots right now. I think Gitz are harder to play than Thorns are, but particularly I think the way that Jimmy was playing them, I just think they can be a real, real nightmare once you get used to the deck. Interestingly, I think that everything after that is like just really, really even. Like obviously Skaven did really well. I think Hrothgorn is still quite viable. He's just not as good at everything all at once as he was before. I think Harrows are still really good. I think they got hit pretty hard with the universals, so I think people may have to figure out, you know, what the best cards to take are when the universals got restricted. But I think they still have a good toolkit, and I think we'll see more of them. Profiteers, I still think, are quite solid. I think they can do aggro well. I think they can do some of the passive styles. I think Farstriders are in it as well. So it's just really cool how many different things are viable, and like we have to think about so many more matchups than we did before.
Yes. So I generally agree with most of the comments and placements that you had for the warbands. I think Thorns are definitely at the top of the pile still.
I think so.
They're definitely doing what they've always done, and to some degree doing it just as well, if not perhaps even more refined. I do think that To the End and Digging Deep and Frenzied Surgeon and Natural Truce kind of helps level the playing field a lot. A lot of people take that option, especially when you're playing Lost Pages or Tomes. But even in general, the fact that, you know, if you just can survive and just draw, it's a great three glory over the course of the game. And it's pretty conducive to helping you win because card advantage is a thing, right? And you might not necessarily get card advantage from Unnatural Truce in particular, but over the course of the game, if you draw through all of your deck and your opponent doesn't, you know, you have more options. And again, you can play into your strategy better. So that right there kind of throws everything for a loop because, you know, there are warbands that I think are still statistically, or just looking at their stats rather, better than others and their cards. But it's just that concept of, you know, what do they want to tailor into and how much passive glory can they get? And this may be like an interesting way for the game because, like, you know, the game is probably, if you look at all these winning decks, aside from the Wild Hunt, it's all about scoring glory while either holding something or playing cards. And while that is a departure from where the game originally had its, you know, roots from in regards to Shadespire and to an extent Night Vault, much of Night Vault actually, it does help again bring that level of equilibrium because again you don't have to rely on your fighter stats more so than what you're just putting in your deck and what cards that your faction may have that helps you accomplish those things. So I do think Rippas is probably one that I wouldn't have put in the upper middle level of things. But, I mean, again, it's really a wide-open slate. Like, there are Despoilers in the top 12, and I talk bad about them all the time, right? So I don't think they're a bad warband, but I just didn't think they have the tools. But if people can find the tools, which, again, I think the tools are out there, whether you want to go for stacking upgrades on through Lost Pages or Tomes, or if you wanted to go to the end, like, you can take a deck that literally has all its win conditions by scoring cards through power cards and things happening on the board that you can control almost regularly. So whichever warbands can tap into those strategies more so, is probably going to do well. I don't know if I have a meta pick. I can very confidently say Thorns are at the top, and then you probably have everyone else in a very tight group of varying levels afterwards. I still think like more bands like Condemners, Chosen Axes, Reavers, Orcs, and Godsworn are probably at the bottom of the totem pole. I don't know if Eyes are going to be able to repeat that performance, so I would stick them probably somewhere in like the middle to bottom tier. I'm surprised there are no Magors, but again, maybe now is not the time for aggro unless they can kind of create some sort of draw / passive aggro build. I'm not really sure. And then guard.
Yeah, I don't think Magors have this quite as good. Like, I would say the other aggro war band would be Rippas and Wild Hunt, and I think Magors may have better fighters, but I don't know if they have better like end phase objectives.
Correct. Which, yeah, it was exactly what I'm saying is like maybe they can flex into something else that can help them achieve that, right? Because right now like movement is so important, and Rippas and Wild Hunt have movement, but if you get max offset, you pretty much lose that game. I know that Jimmy tried something with Magors earlier last fall that kind of tried to take advantage of that. But you have the tools now. Like you can make a deck. Like they have a draw card, Magors, where if they get a kill, they can draw two cards, right? So you can probably play the to the end play style with Magors and things like that. But this is
probably interesting.
This is probably the most balanced meta we've seen, at least from an initial perspective. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are some clear winners over the next 4 weeks. And now it depends on how high those winners are above the rest of the pack, which I don't think there will be that much higher than perhaps as we saw at like the tail end of Night Vault or during the Grimwatch and Mantrapper dominance that we saw recently. So I know that's kind of a cop-out, but I mean, I really can't make a call like that because I don't know. Do I want to see some warbands do really well? Yeah, like I want Wild Hunt to be the best warband in the game, right? But I don't know if they will be. I do think Nurgle took a hit, though, on that same bane. I think Nurgle is no longer at the top, but they're still solid.
Yeah, we did see one in the top eight, which was cool to see that somebody is still doing well with them. But I know that overall they didn't do quite as well. Some of the other players didn't have nearly as much success. So that is interesting. I guess they were probably a little bit reliant on the power of some of the universals. But, I mean, really the fact that I would say there might be like 12 warbands right now that I wouldn't be surprised if somebody did really well with. Is just super cool. So I'm really excited about the meta here.
I mean, I'll be surprised if Eyes of the Nine and Despoilers consistently do well. I would love to be proven wrong, but I'd still like. I think this is still like very much so like new meta. You don't know what to expect. You get caught off guard. Type of situation, and that doesn't take away from the top eight or the top four. Like those guys knew what they were doing and they did it well, but I think overall, like, as you know, whether you're submarining early on intentionally or unintentionally, or the way certain matchups plays out, so
that's what I did. Is I lost my first two games and then submarine to 16th.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
the highest of the two and twos.
Yeah, I mean, it happens, right? And you can just get really boned by matchups. Like, you can, you know, I played Gitz one time, and I played three Hawthorns and Farshredders. It is what it is, right? Like, you can't you can't do anything about it.
I got demolished by Rippas, and then I played the person that won the event. So, can't be too mad about any of that.
Yeah. And then sometimes just things don't work out. Like, maybe you thought your deck would work or it wouldn't, and dice can be a big factor because this is a dice-based game at the end of the day. But then again, you see strategies where people are taking the reliance off dice. Which is probably it makes the most sense, right? Take advantage of the things you can take advantage of. Do I think Underworld should be played in that way? I think maybe we can cover a whole episode like that. I don't know if that's the intention of the way the game was designed to be played. It's an arena combat game. But more and more I'm seeing less combat and more drawing and holding objectives. So
I do think a lot of that just has to do with the cards that are available. I think that, you know, with the warbands that are able to take things like Slay the Corrupted and the Nurgle version and the Hrothgorn version, I think we will see, some more aggro stuff. But I think our end phase cards right now are really determining what is viable.
Yeah.
And that's going to be uncontested. That's going to be to the end. That's going to be, you know, path to victory. So it's an interesting direction that Beastgrave is sort of going.
Yeah. Interesting is probably the most neutral and apt word I can use at the moment. So
I guess the next question is, what warbands do you think you need to plan for if you're going to an event in the current meta? And maybe not just warbands, but what play styles?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think you definitely have to look out for Thorns. And Thorns probably is an umbrella over the fact that Gitz, Guard, and Grimwatch can probably do similar things. Right. You'll probably see Thorns and Guard try to do the most similar thing, which is kind of run around and hold stuff, and then use like 2-3 of their fighters to try to fight you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Gitz is a slightly more different, like, flexi style. Like, it was really interesting. Like, Jimmy's deck had a bunch of Amberbone weapons, but it also had keys in it. So it was really interesting to see how it functioned as a whole. So I would say objective play. I would actually, instead of focusing on warbands, I would focus on cards. Uncontested is everywhere, which is interesting because a lot of these decks are trying to contest objectives. So stop uncontested, or have tools to stop uncontested. You're not going to be able to stop the draw stuff, so don't even worry about it. Maybe tech into it yourself. As you mentioned earlier, it looks like Wild Hunt and Rippas are maybe, hopefully, making a climb back up the ranks. So if so, be prepared to have games where you have to be really aggressive or defensive, or react to some really aggressive gameplay. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think disruption is your greatest friend in this game, whether it's setting up the boards to where you're disrupting the enemy's intended playstyle, or taking cards that disrupt stuff. So moving forward, you do not leave home without Mischievous Spirits, I don't think, in this meta. You must take that in distraction. That's 20% of your gambits. You know, like, you have to take that no matter what. There are some other cards you can probably tech into, but you really want those two, because everyone is trying to do something with objectives. I mean, I don't know, maybe Skaven might see a rise because of Ollie's success. I think Profiteers are always omnipresent. And then I think you're going to be seeing some Cursebreakers too. Cursebreakers, while they lost Harness the Storm, like, I built a deck that functions probably just as well as they did before, and there's no Harness the Storm in it. And we talked about this last time, right?
Yeah.
You could take Axie, Well of Power, and Tome of Offerings instead. So Stormsire is a monster. And he single-handedly carries that warband, and then Amos is a great offensive threat.
The magic disruption as well, with like Unmaking and things like that, is, I think, really good too.
Yeah, great point. And then I think Molog too. Like, always be like, I guess generally, you probably want Glory Seeker, because there's going to be like people who are going to tech into the big guys, and then 4-wound fighters are always a pain.
Yeah.
And then you're going to want the objective destruction. I think Lost Pages and Tomes are going to come back. I mean, Lost Pages is already here. I think Tomes are coming back. Because you can really make a deck that just draws, scores you a couple glory. You play the cards you drew to score other cards, and then you stack Tomes. And it's not really uninteractive, and you win the game.
Yeah, that's true. I guess the interesting thing about the To the End build is that it only takes one restricted card in Frenzied Search. So maybe if you had another way to draw cards, like a couple warbands do, but with that one restricted card, that still leaves you a lot of other options on what you need to do. So you could probably do aggro and To the End, because I think with those two card draw, Unnatural Truce and Frenzied Search, it's not like you really have to spend that much time drawing cards as activations, although it's nice to do it in the beginning. You're pretty much going to get your scores there.
Right on, I completely agree.
Yeah, so in the end right now, I think that, like, when you're building a deck that you want to take to a large event, I think you covered a lot of it. I think basically you need to be prepared for uncontested. I've seen a number of games with even someone playing aggro. You need to remember that you need to be on an objective against a lot of these warbands. They probably have uncontested. I think you could take Uncontested in a Profiteer's deck. I think you could take it in a, maybe probably an Eyes deck, or the winning Eyes deck had it, you know. I think you could probably take it in Yul'Thari's. So I think Uncontested is a card that you basically have to play in a counter. I think maybe Sidestep is a good card again. I think you're absolutely right about Mischievous Spirits. You just have to be able to block that, because if the opponent scores Uncontested, if you don't really make them work for that, then that could win them the game pretty much right there. And then I think you're right that there's not a lot of counter to the end strategy, but it does mean that they're down on power cards a little bit, because it's not really like Frenzied Surge and Uncontested in the long run are doing anything for them. They're just giving them maybe a burst of power with their cards. But if you have more, I think maybe if you have more cards in your deck that actually do something for you, you know, maybe that is viable. I mean, I don't think Tommy had any card draw at all in his. He just had more cards that he could actually use. So obviously that's a viable strategy as well. One interesting thing I noticed from the Gits and the Thorns and decks and things like that is it seems like keys are back. I think probably because we'll see less Nightmare in the Shadows, Distraction, Restless Prize, I think we're going to see a lot less of. Although one thing I think I do want to add is that I think that Nightmare in the Shadows and Restless Prize are worth a restricted slot quite a lot if you're trying to do any of these strategies. If anything, Restless Prize is now even harder to counter because most other people aren't going to have it. So if you really need an objective for your strategy, Restless Prize is going to let you.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and as far as like aggro goes, I think there is a viable aggro strategy. I think it's just only open to the warbands that have passive, not necessarily passive, but like end phase cards like Slay the Corrupted, like Butchering, things like that, that'll help counter the to the end. If I wipe you out and you get to the end, but I get Butchering, then, you know, it didn't really matter. So, and then, and you spent a lot of cards not doing anything, and hopefully, you know, other than drawing through your deck to score it. If I kill you, I've killed you, and I've scored all my end stuff. So I think in some ways, the hard aggro style can try to counter that card draw style. And I think the objective decks can absolutely outscore it. So it's a cool kind of, I mean, we're kind of back to objectives, control, and aggro. And depending on which one ends up being the most prominent, I think we'll have to build to beat that one while still being aware of the other one. So I think we're back to like probably I would consider a healthy meta, and we'll just see over the next couple events and weeks that, you know, just what comes out on top and how do we need to plan from there.
Yeah, I think that was very well said, and I think it's kind of funny how we went in a roundabout manner, prepare for everything.
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, that's what you have to do. Look at the top strategies and make sure you have the cards to either counter them, or you just have the cards that way you don't care about them. So,
yeah.
I love aggro, so I hope we see more of it. I'll be doing my part to make sure we do. At least I'll try.
Yeah, I have to say that the Hrothgorn deck I played, it was a lot of fun. I had Victoria's Duel. I had the two quarry death kills, or hunter kills a quarry, and things like that. And I've missed playing aggro, and I may just keep trying to do it. I don't know if it's the best way, but I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the best way to stay in the game too, right? It's really hard to keep motivated during these times when there's no like store events. And I think we've been really spoiled with Underworld, is that there's like a trophy, right, for everything we do.
Yeah.
Whether it's a store event or something, it's always something we can clamor for and fight for. But in this case, like, if you can't, but you want to get some games in, just have fun and play something that's fun and that you enjoy, and I promise you along the way you'll find success.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time I think the people that end up having some of the most impressive showings are the people that, you know, it's not necessarily the ones that want to win the event, but it's the ones that say, I'm going to try to make the Eyes of the Nine the best they can be. And then when they do it, everyone's like, oh, wow, that's awesome. You know, And so I think we'll see a lot more of that kind of thing now with the FAR, and it just really excites me for what's to come. I just wish there were some big events to go to.
Don't we all? Again, very well said, and the meta's looking solid. So, hopefully those tips there help you prepare for the meta, and if not, maybe give you some ideas to take the meta forward in a new direction. Right before we close, I just always want to remind everyone that we would love to hear your thoughts on anything that we do in regards to the game, whether it's podcast or questions for Jonathan's Well of Power or Hexes and Warbands for myself. In addition to that, if there's any cool things that you see in the meta or in the come up in your personal games as well, and you'd love to hear our thoughts on it. We love answering questions. It's a lot of fun and lets us do what we love best, which is ramble. So please help with those questions.
Clearly that is our favorite. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can both go on quite a bit of tangents here and there, but specifically, if you have a certain warband that you're excited to play more of after the FAR, do let us know. We'd love to hear about it, talk about it in the Discord. And then if there's anything that you think you need to plan for in the future meta, please share that with us. Not only does it promote conversation, but it also gives us healthy ideas for everyone who's reading the conversation as well. So please do let us know. We're looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everyone, that is it for this episode. If you have any feedback, questions, or comments, let us know on Facebook at Path to Glory Podcast. You can also follow us on Podbean, where you can find the show notes for this episode. Rate us on iTunes, as it helps us get to more people. If you'd like to support us in more tangible ways, you can do that on our Patreon at patreon.com/pathtoglory. And please join our Discord if you'd like to ask us questions or hang out, play games, any of that. And just thanks for listening. We wish you the best of luck on your path to glory.
Nice. Everything is online.
Everything is online.